I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 140 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is one of the most revered bassists in rock, someone particularly known for the memorable parts he has played with Joe Jackson. Graham Mabey. The modest, good-humored Mabey now lives on Long Island, but he grew up in England, where he discovered the wonders of the Beatles and Paul McCartney's bass playing. There he met keyboardist and percussionist Joe Jackson, and the two of them formed a band called Arms and Legs with another lead singer. They released three singles for a label owned by a certain Irish singer-songwriter. But when those songs didn't take off, the musicians found themselves alone again, naturally. Jackson decided he wanted to front his own band with Mabey at his side and the bass front and center. How did Mabey like that idea? Did he have confidence in Jackson's abilities as a lead singer? Jackson's Look Sharp from early 1979 is one of the all-time great debut albums, and Mabey's bass is often the lead instrument. He's not only driving the rhythm, but also playing indelible counter melodies on songs such as One More Time, Sunday Papers, and the hit single, Is She Really Going Out With Him? How fully formed were these arrangements when Jackson presented them to the band? What role did Mabey have in shaping his parts? I'm the Man, Jackson's second album that year, followed in a similar vein and spawned the single It's Different for Girls. Don't you know that it's different for girls? You are the same. Mabey tells how he got a rare lead vocal on the title track of the reggae-flavored Beat Crazy from 1980. That album used the same musicians, with Gary Sanford on guitar and David Houghton on drums, but was the first credited to the Joe Jackson Band. And it was the last Joe Jackson Band album until 2003. Mabey explains. Mabey stayed aboard as Jackson continued his stylistic shifting with Joe Jackson's Jump and Jive, the salsa-tinged Night and Day, the Mike's Murder soundtrack, and the jazzy Body and Soul. What in Jackson's process changed with Night and Day? Why did that breakthrough album feel risky at the time? How much were Jackson and Mabey paying attention to Elvis Costello, who also had progressed from angry young new waver to sophisticated pop craftsman? How did Mabey wind up working with Marshall Crenshaw? How did Crenshaw's approach to the bass parts differ from Jackson's? How did Mabey get back in the fold with Jackson? Mabey has played on most of Jackson's albums since 1989's Blaze of Glory, including 2019's The Fool. I saw the belated tour for that album in 2022, and Mabey, Jackson, and the band sounded great. Mabey is not part of Jackson's current music hall production, Mr. Joe Jackson Presents Max Champion and What a Racket. Does Mabey envision recording and performing with Jackson again? And what does Mabey consider his superpower? He's certainly as mild-mannered as he is super talented. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Graham Mabey.
Where are you, Mark?
I'm in Evanston, Chicago area.
Okay. You know, I used to live there in, from 83 through 85. I lived in Chicago.
Really? Where?
On Sheridan Avenue, sort of around Lincoln Park, Belmont Harbor. Right.
Oh, nice. I lived on Oakdale and on Surf. So right between Belmont and Diversity.
Yeah. That's pretty close to where we were. We were actually, we had a place on Wellington.
Oh, yeah, you were just right around
like
the corner.
A block away from Oakdale, right?
Yeah, it goes Wellington, Oakdale.
Isn't there a thing called the Woogums?
Yes,
Society?
The Woogums.
Remember
I know. The Woogums Parade.
And it was the Wellington, Oakdale, Old Glory Marching Society. We were right at Broadway. We were very close to Broadway.
Yeah, you're right there. Well, you should come back. There's some,
I love Chicago. I mean, I went through a big self-inflicted upheaval in 1983 and took myself from England to the USA. And I because I was in love with a Chicagoan.
Oh, nice.
And I ended up living there for 2 years, and I took the city to my heart and became a Cubs fan.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know, right? Everybody says that. But I went to games and went to saw a lot of music, and I loved it there. But unfortunately, all the work I was getting was centered around New York. So we ended up moving to New York in 85.
Because Joe Jackson had moved to New York, right? Because you were both Brits, obviously, and he moved to New York.
He was already living
Chicago.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was renting a place and was living there when we did Night and Day, which was early 1982.
Right, right.
He was already there, and he's basically been there ever since. He has a place in Soho in New York, but he also obviously has a place in England as well. So he divides his time. For a long time, he had a place in Berlin too, but I think he's let that go now. But
yeah, I'd read something from some years back where he'd moved to Berlin because he was mad at New York for its indoor smoking ban.
Yeah, well, there's more than a grain of truth to that. Yep. Yeah, that's sort of how he ended up there. He just said, fuck it, I'm going to move to Berlin. You know, it was like, I think there were other factors involved. In other words, he knew people that lived in Berlin that were telling him, oh, come here, you can smoke, and it's affordable, and it's a great cultural scene, and the wall just came down, and it's really cool. And he did, and he loved it there for years. For probably 15 years, he had a place there. So.
And he's still smoking?
Yeah, he doesn't smoke that much, but it's the principle of the thing, I think, that really irritated him. It was the Michael Bloomberg years.
Right.
Following the Giuliani years I think Joe felt like the city lost its character. You know, Joe loves a bit of sleaze, you know? And there was plenty of that before 42nd Street became Disney Northeast.
Disneyfied, yeah.
Yeah, so.
So where are you right now?
I live on Long Island.
Okay.
New York. Yeah.
How long have you been there?
It's been coming up 9 years. I can't believe it, but coming up 9 years. Yeah. So the girl from Chicago, who I moved from England for, she unfortunately passed away in 2012.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. And so I had a couple of years there from 2012 and through 2014 of floundering around aimlessly like a rudderless ship. And then I very fortunately met Maureen, who I married in 2017. And she had a house here in Long Island and kept saying, you should just come live here. So I did, eventually.
And you like it?
I do. I do. It's, you know, I lived in Jersey long enough to become an honorary Jerseyan. And I know a lot of good friends and great musicians that I worked with through the years in Jersey. And it was hard for me to extricate myself from that. But I don't regret it. I think it was probably a change that needed to be made. You know, it's also to do with how old I am and everything else that's going on in my life. It wasn't just music. And it certainly hasn't prevented me from doing anything music-wise. And having said that, I don't do as much now as I used to. You know, I'm in my 70s now, so you know, I'm okay with kicking back a little more.
So do you play at home a lot? Do you only play when you have jobs? Like, what is your routine like?
Oh yeah, I still take my bass to bed and snuggle up to it. No, I don't play. I only play bass if I have a reason. I have a acoustic guitar and I have a couple of ukuleles, and that's my noodling instruments that I pick up every day. And, you know, if I've got a tune in my head, I'll try and play it, you know, that kind of thing. Bass, if I've got a gig coming up or I have a reason. So I'm afraid I'm not really a good advertisement for young bass players who I should be saying practice every day, you know. And
well, you've done your share though. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, I told
a friend of mine who's a journalist and a bassist, and also has like does you know has produced some bands in his studio, that I was talking to you, and he was just like so excited. And he's like, you know, I used to just like listen to his playing, like he and Colin Moulding, you know, in the early '80s. I would just like listen to his playing on those early, you know, Joe Jackson records, and you know, Colin Moulding, and they were just like my idols and the ones who I was trying to be like. He's like, so you know, probably won't come up, but. You know, you could tell them that I'm a huge fan. I'm like, I'll tell them. Sure. Why not?
Well, so. Thank you very much. It's nice to have appreciation. I've been lucky to receive a lot of positive feedback for my work. So, you know, yeah. Thank you to your friend.
I will tell Lou. At what point did you decide I'm going to be a bassist as opposed to, you know, playing guitar or doing something else in a rock band or not doing something else in a rock band?
Well, the story is that I was 16 years old. Actually, I was 15 years old, and I was studying for my O-level exams in England. And I was a rabid Beatle fan and a fan of other music, too, of course, but especially the Beatles. That was like, they were the guys that got me started. I heard Love Me Do on the radio, and it was like everything from there I consumed voraciously. But when I was 15, I just knew that I wanted a guitar. I had to have a guitar. And I told my parents, and they said, well, if you pass your O-levels, you know, we'll get you a guitar for your 16th birthday. And that's what happened. So I taught myself to play the acoustic, and I'd been playing for about a year. And then there was a fella in my class at school whose name, funnily enough, was John Jackson, no relation whatsoever.
Right.
And John, he played the piano, I knew, but I also knew he played the guitar. And one day he came up to me at school and he said that he knew a guy who was actually a bloke. He said, I know a bloke who's selling two guitars. One of them's a six string electric and the other one's a bass. He said, I'm going to buy this six string. And he said, I thought you might want to buy the bass. And I don't know why he thought that. I'd never played the bass before. But I guess based on our conversations or something, he just had a feeling.
And he wanted the guitar. So, you know, he wanted it to work out.
I know. So I went with him. That was my very first bass that I bought in 69.
What kind of bass is it?
It's kind of a piece of junk, really. But it's an Eco.
EKO.
Yeah, they're affordable. You know, they're like the Silvertones of Italy or something, you know.
Right.
There was a lot of I mean, even Hofners were not expensive guitars back in their day. And so it was kind of like that. And I saw it and I was like, oh, my God, I got to have that. And partly because it was violin shaped and McCartney had a violin shaped bass. And
right.
And that's the guitar I did take to bed with, snuggle up with.
Did you practice to McCartney's parts on Beatle records at that point?
Oh, everything. Just, you know, because everyone I knew, I didn't know anyone that was taking lessons. You know, it didn't even occur to me that you could take lessons. That's how, I mean, this was the late 60s. So I just thought everyone did what I was doing, which is sitting at home listening to records and figuring it out. And honestly, Mark, that was just such a joy to figure it out and just to learn that way rather than having someone tell you. I think it would have, the way I played would have been a lot different if that had been the case. The joy at that time was figuring it out. And so that's what I did.
Did you have a sense that you were kind of instinctively really good at it in a way that you maybe, I don't know how good of a guitarist you are, but did you feel like you were sort of a more distinctive bass player than a guitar player at that point?
I wouldn't say I was distinctive. I wasn't thinking about being distinctive. I knew I had a good ear. I knew I was, people told me from very early on that I was quick at picking things up. So I kind of knew I had that going for me. And honestly, that's really, to me, that's the main thing I've had going for me my whole life, is just having a good ear, being quick at picking things up. And the other thing is, it's a bit like being punctual. You know, I like to turn up for rehearsals or any situation. I like to be prepped. I like to know what's going on. I don't want to waste people's time and I don't want to embarrass myself. So I'd rather put the time in and be ready.
It seems like there are two aspects to having a good ear. One would be, you know, you hear what key the song is, what the chord changes are, what sort of goes with that. But then the other aspect of it is hearing what would complement that in ways that other people wouldn't think of. So like there are plenty of bass players who play in tune, but you have so many songs where you're providing these like counter melodies to what's going on. And that's like that's a whole sort of creative element to having a good ear. That's not the same as just going boo, 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 or whatever, you know, someone's keeping time.
Well, I've had good guides. I mean, Joe, I mean, just right here, now you've said that, I want to make it clear that so just to digress and to lead into an answer to that, you know, while the rest of us were sitting at home listening to records in our bedrooms, figuring things out, you know, there was this guy that I met in 1974, 50 years ago.
Wow.
Called Joe Jackson, who was 19 years old at that time and was going to the Royal Academy of Music in London, studying, majoring in percussion, even though piano was his main instrument. And he was the only person I knew who was like a legit music student. And Joe, from the very earliest days, we were in a cover band together and we would sneak an original song in. If it was a Joe song, he would always have a fully formed idea of what he wanted everybody to do, including the bass. So it's not like I made up the bass lines on Look Sharp. I didn't make them up. Nobody made anything up on that album. Joe had a clear idea.
Really?
Drums should do this. The guitar should be doing this. The bass should be doing this. Yeah, you know, the left hand on the piano said, this is the basic idea. And then you take the idea and you run with it. So it's not like every note I played was dictated, but the core ideas, the core parts that everyone is playing, he had a fully formed notions of that.
Interesting. Well, before Look Sharp, you were in a band with him called Arms and Legs. Is that the one that did the covers?
Oh yeah.
And it says I read that you had a different singer, so he wasn't the singer. You had someone named Mark Andrews was the singer, and you did three singles with Gilbert O'Sullivan's label.
Gilbert O'Sullivan's label was called MAM. And he was their big artist, and we got signed to MAM, but they were a little on the fence about us, so they allowed us, God, in very magnanimously, they allowed us to cut three singles, and the idea was if the singles did okay, then we could do an album, and the three singles all bombed, and. That was the end of that. And
were they covers or were they Joe songs? Did you write anything? Did this Mark Andrews write anything? How did that work?
Yeah, Mark Andrews wrote two of the A sides and Joe got two of the B sides. And that was one of the reasons why Joe got miffed and left the band, is because he was writing much more sophisticated songs with like kind of Steely Dan suspended chords and things. And Mark was writing these real like in your face, hooky pop songs that weren't anywhere near as sophisticated as Joe's. And we were all good friends and everything. But when we got our little record deal, the producer really liked Mark's songs because he thought, well, these are the ones that are likely to be the hits. So
what'd they sound like?
Not very good.
A lot of the so-called new wavers in like 74 were doing, you know, quote unquote pub rock. So I don't know if you guys were in the pub rock.
We were sort of in that bracket. Yeah. Yeah. But we didn't really fit with that either because we weren't listening to that kind of music. We would have listening parties the whole bit where we'd listen to Bob Marley and we'd listen to Little Feat and we'd listen to Steely Dan. And we were listening to interesting pop music. We weren't exactly a part of that. Actually, I mean, once I heard Graham Parker, for instance, I thought, wow, this is brilliant. But Joe was the one that turned me on to that. I didn't, you know, a lot. And, you know, a lot of that punk rock music that came out, I really loved that. But that wasn't exactly what we were doing. But, you know, I mean, I thought that Pistols album was phenomenally good. Hmm. You know, but the only album they ever made, but it sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so, and then The Damned and The Clash, and I loved all that. I didn't really think that we fit into that. And of course, when Joe's first album came out, he got kind of like a lot of the critics were very fond of lumping him in with Graham Parker and Elvis Costello and
right.
blah, 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 which, you know, I mean, you know, I guess music critics, along with everybody, we're just looking for a way to categorize everything to make it easy and more palatable, blah, you know, whatever. But the thing about Joe, I think, is that he evolved into something else, you know, like kind of like Sting or even Elvis. It's like what was going on at the time was that high energy music with attitude, and the Police certainly were that, and so was Elvis at the beginning. But as time's gone by, you know, they've all found their real voices. And
the Joe Jackson stuff, the Elvis Costello stuff, I was on to right at the beginning. And I remember the first two albums, both bands, even though Costello had the Attractions, the second one, it was like, boom, you know, like bursting out. This is new wave, whether you guys thought of it like that or not. And then Beat Crazy, you're going kind of in this reggae thing, and he's doing, you know, his kind of stack stuff with Get Happy, his fourth album. And then he's doing almost blue country, and you're doing Jump and Jive. And then Night and Day and Imperial Bedroom are both the same year too. And they both have these kind of Baroque, very sophisticated pop craftsmanship things going on in them too. So I remember I kind of go back and forth between the two, very different, but both of them kind of, you know, turning back on the sort of, you know, the angry young man stereotype that I think both of, you know, both got tagged with at the beginning.
And as I said, that, especially those two albums, Imperial Bedroom and Night and Day, I think, to me, Night and Day is when Joe really, he made demos for Night and Day, which is the first time he'd ever made demos. Usually it would be like we would learn stuff in rehearsal and play it out live. But he had actually, we'd had a big long break, and he had made some demos. And I remember listening to Breaking Us in Two and Stepping Out, and I remember thinking, well, these are great songs, but it's so different from what he's known for. I wonder if his audience are going to get it. And I had these sort of doom and gloom thoughts that maybe, you know, maybe they wouldn't. And that's the end of it, you know. And how wrong I was. It ended up being his biggest selling album.
You were incorrect.
So, yeah, and he found his real, he found a way to really express his real voice, which is way more sophisticated. I think the high energy new wave, whatever you want to call it, was a foot in the door, so to speak, you know, for him.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, the new sponsor of the Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago. Congratulations, Revolution! Revolution is Illinois' largest independent brewery and the maker of, among other great beers, the classic Antihero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. On these scorching summer days, Cold Time really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. So that's 74. I think you said you met Joe. 78 is Look Sharp. So what happened in between there?
Well, we made the three singles in 1975, 6. That was when the singles were being cut. We got dropped, I think. I can't quite remember. It was either later in 76 or maybe early 77. The third single before we got dropped was the one that actually got airplay on BBC radio. Mm. How ironic is that, you know? And it wasn't a hit, but it got more radio play than the other two put together. So, but Joe, yeah, he was kind of like a little disillusioned, and he went off and he did a bunch of backing up cabaret and stuff like that, making some money. He'd never really made any money. We didn't make any money with arms and legs at all. So he went off and made some money, and we stayed in touch, he and I, throughout. And he was telling me he'd been writing a lot of songs on the road. And he came back and we recorded four songs at a local demo studio. And then he was off again doing his cabaret backing act thing, you know. And then he came back and we recorded four more. And this happened, there were three batches of four, which basically constituted the Look Sharp album by the time we had finished those 12 songs. And I remember, I always tell people, I remember sitting and listening to all 12 of those songs together at one point when Joe was telling me he was going to take the demo recordings to London and find a record deal. And I listened to them all together and I thought, wow, this is really good. You know, maybe that MAM debacle was not the end of it. And sure enough, he, through another happy series of coincidences, he met David Kirschenbaum, who was working for A&M Records and was in London looking for new talent, specifically, you know, like rock, new wave, whatever they were calling it.
Right.
And Joe's demo tape came to his attention, and he was so excited about it. He wanted to get us in the studio straight away, and basically we did. So by August of 1978, we were recording Look Sharp, which took a week because we'd already played the songs 100 times. So
what did David Kirschenbaum as a producer bring to that album? And he obviously worked with you guys for a bunch of them after that too.
He didn't really change anything about the arrangements. He just, he was sort of like a vibe guy, you know? So he was, you know, I always remember hearing an interview with Nick Lowe on Terry Gross Fresh Air one time. And she said to Nick Lowe, you know, what do you think the most important quality of a record producer is? And he thought for a second and he said, you got to know a few good jokes. And I feel like Kirschenbaum kind of falls into that category. He's about creating the right atmosphere. And, you know, if anybody's uptight, he's got a good way of defusing tension. And yeah, that's what I remember about him. And the album sounded better because it was engineered by somebody who knew what they were doing. So that was the biggest difference. There really wasn't a huge difference. I still have the demos for Look Sharp.
Oh, I'd love to hear those.
Yeah, there's a few songs that didn't make it that I'm kind of fond of. Yeah, just better production and a tighter band, you know, just because we had played together, we were starting to get tighter and become a band.
So did you guys think of yourselves as the Joe Jackson Band at that point already?
I'm not sure. I think soon, because we started getting billed as Joe Jackson and Band or the Joe Jackson Band. And then by the time that third album called Beat Crazy came out, Joe wanted it to be the Joe Jackson Band. So that's actually what it says on the cover.
Right. Yeah, that's the one that's billed that way. Even though it's the same four guys, it's you two and Gary Sanford on guitar, David Houghton on drums. Those records are very bass forward. So did Joe come in and actually say, this is what the bass part is? Or was it like, here's a general idea and feel your way around it? Like, how did that work?
A general idea. I mean, certain songs are, you know, like if I can give the example of Sunday Papers. In rehearsal one time, we used to rehearse in a Boy Scout, corrugated iron Boy Scout hut, you know. And I remember one day, you know, Joe likes to bang around on the drums, but he's not a drummer, even though his major was percussion. So he's sitting there and he's trying to play the drum part for Dave. So yeah, you know, this is the hi-hat, this is the kick and the snare, and Dave picked it up straight away. And then Joe said to Gary, you know, all right, you've got to play this guitar part it's a jack, jack, jack. So it almost sounds like an R&B guitar part, you know. Old rhythm and blues, I mean. And then he says, and here's the piano part. And he had a Fender Rhodes or something. So he played da 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 da. Right. So then we all played it together for the very first time. We all played it together. And we all just looked at each other like, whoa, that is so cool. So, I mean, a lot of things happened that way. The flourishes, anything I added to it was me, but the basic idea that everyone is doing is out of Joe's head.
Interesting. Because the bass really pops on those. I mean, they're pretty great sounding records. I mean, I was like going back and listening to them at high volume just to, you know, prepare for this. And I know them pretty well already, but it's just, there's a lot of space around those instruments and each instrument just kind of just pops right out of the speakers. And
they're so underproduced too. There's minimal overdub. I think the piano was about the only thing that was overdubbed and maybe some backing vocals, you know. But going back to before we ever, probably when we were still cutting those demos, I remember it was after Joe had left Arms and Legs and he and I were talking and he said, I remember he was saying, well, you know, I've got this idea that I want to front my own band. And right away I was thinking, well, I don't know if he's got the voice to do that.
I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you whether it was a surprise that he wanted to be the singer.
Yeah, because his voice was probably, I mean, he was always a great pianist, but his voice was, it took him a while to really develop the mastery of that instrument and the confidence that you would know him for now. But I remember the first time he told me that he wanted to front his own band, I was like, well, I don't know if you can pull that off. I didn't say it, but I thought it, you know. And then he said, yeah, and I just want it to be guitar, bass, drums, and I'll do a solo here and there, you know. And he said, I want the bass to be like the lead instrument. And then he said, like, what do you think about that? And I'm like, sure, sounds great, please. So the concept going right into those early recordings was that the bass would be front and center.
So when he came in with Is She Really Going Out With Him, did he have that bass part to present to you, or did you, again, sort of figure that out as he was playing it?
Well, he, that's his line. It's just that's the essence of the verse. So
right.
I hope I'm not bursting anyone's bubble, but I mean,
well, you're still playing this stuff. I mean, that's
right. I played it and I originated it and I added to it, but the essence of the idea is Joe's, and so he should get credit where it's due.
Was that consistent throughout? You know, I mean, you've worked with him for decades. Is that something that's always been the case, or were there some projects where, you know, he was more like, all right, I'm, you know, this is sort of a thicker, busier arrangement and just find somewhere to fit in? Did that process change over the years?
Not fundamentally. And actually, you know, I mentioned the fact that when we did Night and Day, he had actually made demos. Once he started making demos, you know, I always have mixed feelings about that, because you have that guide. So it's kind of, it's harder to get away from, because his intentions are made very clear when he's making a demo. So it you know, you have to find a way to take that and still make it your own. So, you know, I have mixed feelings about, and it's funny because I remember the last album we did together was called Fool, which we recorded, I think, 4 years ago. Made really good demos while he was living in Berlin. And he sent the demos to us, and I actually emailed him back, and I said, Joe, could you please make shitty demos so that there's a bit more left to our imagination? I actually said that, because they were so good. I was like, well, some people would just fucking put this out, you know. But we actually got to record it, and it was a lot of fun and everything. But I have had the thought that, you know, sometimes the demo is not your friend, and some people get, you know, I'm not just talking about Joe, and I'm talking about other people I've worked with. Some people get so into the demo that they can't get away from it, you know, even if they want to, if they try to. So demo-itis.
Be crazy. You have the first lead vocal on that record, because you're singing on the title track. So it's sort of like the statement, this is a real band, because there's Graham singing, you know, the first song. How did that happen? And did you like sort of doing the lead vocals on that?
So the reggae stuff that Joe was listening to was a bit like, you know, where there'd be a conventional vocal and then there would be a toast, you know,
right.
And that was the idea behind that. So I was like doing the conventional melody verse, and then he would come in with the toasty part.
Right. You
know? Yeah. Out of the three band members, I guess I had the strongest voice for that part. So, I was jazzed to do that, you know. I enjoyed it, and it was an honor to be the first guest vocalist on a Joe album.
No, your voice is really sweet on that. It sounds great with, you know, and then Joe jumping in.
Yeah, I think it worked pretty well. Yeah, but yeah, people seem to like that one. But I was gonna say, just going back to your earlier point, when Dave Houghton left the band at the end of that tour, the Beat Crazy tour, Joe was he was flailing around like a rudderless ship, because he didn't want to, you know. Dave was a very dear friend to all of us, and it was a little heartbreaking to lose him, and Joe didn't just want to find another drummer and carry on as before. So we took a couple of months, and then Joe came back and said, oh, I've been listening to all this, you know, 40s, 50s jump blues, Cab Calloway and Louis Jordan. And I want to just do some gigs with a lineup like that, just for fun. And I listened to it and I was like, well, this is great, but I've never played anything like that before. He said, oh, you can do it. You can do it. Like, oh, all right. Okay. So I borrowed a very old Fender P bass, and my friend Larry came in on drums. There's another local boy, and then we found a horn section and a piano player. And what I loved about that, just going back to my earlier point, is there were no demos. Obviously, we just listened to the old recordings, And then we just hammered out some new arrangements. And so that was really, really fun. I love that tour so much. And then Joe's manager said, "Well, Joe, this is so good. You know, I'm gonna play, you know, I think you should record this." And Joe was like, "You're crazy." And somehow Joe's manager, John, convinced Derek Green at A&M Records to let us record it, which is, I mean, think about that, you know, like we've been this kind of new wave, I don't know what we were, and then we're doing that, you know, like it was, yeah. I was thinking, people going to get this? Are people going to hate it? Or what's going to happen? We ended up doing a pretty fairly successful British tour and a US tour. And I don't think anyone asked for their money back, except for one guy in San Francisco who started heckling Joe and said, "You know, you're not doing your hits. I want my money back." So Joe said, "All right, come up here and I'll give you your money back." And the guy started walking up to the stage and Joe's reaching in his pocket for his wallet. Huh. And the crowd started heckling this guy, and he lost his nerve and he kind of like turned around and fled.
Blinked out.
And that was the only person. But I did think that maybe there might be some people who were pissed off that we weren't doing the stuff that they might have been expecting to hear. But
it was pretty well known what he was doing at that point, though. So you know what?
Some people don't really pay attention, you know. I mean, Joe is doing a tour right now, and I wonder if everybody's paying attention to what's actually he's doing. You know, he's got this album out called, I don't know if you're
aware. What a Racket. Yeah, no, I was going to ask you about that, all that music hall stuff, which you're not.
We went to see it at the Apollo last week. It was great. It was really good. I loved it. And I'm not doing it because Joe wanted a kind of an authentic period mini orchestra and no electric instruments. And I do not play upright bass. So that kind of left me out. But it's really good. But once again, you know, I got a feeling there's some people in the audience that are like, "What the hell is this?" You know, if you're not really.
Yeah. No, it's very different. I was listening to it. And I mean, he's got the accent. He's got the showman.
Oh, yeah, you know,
the showmanship going on. I mean, it's just a totally different thing.
When he was first starting out, before I ever met him, when he was in his teens, he was playing in pubs on old out-of-tune stand-up pianos, playing pub songs and probably a number of songs from that era, because that's what people in pubs wanted to hear, and they'd all sing along, you know. So some of the songs from the early 1900s music hall era were still the staples of pub piano music back then.
Why did David Houghton leave after the Beat Crazy tour?
Well, two reasons. One was his personal life. He's breaking up with his wife, and it was a painful time for him. And I think he had two children at that point, and I think it was all too much for him. But the other reason was he was experiencing some Andy Partridge syndrome. He was getting stage fright or performance anxiety, whatever you want to call it. And it was getting bad, you know, because we were playing to bigger and bigger audiences. So he was fine when we started out and playing pubs and clubs. But as it got bigger, Dave's nerves got the better of him. Once we were on stage playing, he was fine, but it was the waiting and the build up. He was a nervous wreck. And I think it wasn't good for him. So he left the band.
So it didn't have to do with the music you were playing or the fact that you had done more reggae or anything like that. It was just.
No, it wasn't musical differences. No, absolutely not.
Did it change things going forward? You know, that, you know, after the first three albums, there wasn't a fixed band and he could kind of, I mean, obviously Night and Day, you have a lot of salsa stuff, Jump and Jive. He had this other lineup. It kind of opened things up in some ways, even though obviously, you know, you guys are really versatile as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I have to thank Joe, those fast walking bass lines on Jump and Jive, and then having to learn to play, you know, Latin bass lines that never land on the one, which like did my head in at first, you know, like trying to, I mean, I just hadn't listened to that kind of music very much, you know. Yeah, over the years, he's thrown me some curveballs. And I mean, I have to be thankful because he's had faith that I can rise to the occasion. And pretty much, I've been able to be involved in a large proportion of his projects, and you know, I totally respect him as an artist, and I appreciate the trust and the faith he's put in me through the years. I do appreciate that. I mean, he can be a pain in the ass, but that's another story. But you know, I really have to be grateful for that vote of confidence that he has given me through the years. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there are any major artists who aren't pains in the ass at some point. I think that's part of the job description. Because you got to get your vision across. How much of an adjustment was it for you to work with a lot of different drummers?
It was only, I would say, an adjustment in the 80s. I see, here's the thing. I'd only worked with Joe. And the best drummer I'd ever worked with was Dave Houghton. And so when he left, oh, and then Larry. And I knew Larry Tolfrey very well. And the first thing we did together was Jump and Jive. So that, you know, that was kind of different because we were playing a certain style together. So the first tour that Larry and I did together as a rhythm section really was the tour where we were playing arrangements off of the songs off of the earlier Joe album albums, as well as the Night and Day stuff. But I didn't, you know, Gary Burke was the first American drummer I worked with. So I really hadn't worked with a lot of people. I mean, I wasn't that confident in my versatility, my ability to be versatile. When we did the Body and Soul album, which was 1984, which is when Gary Burke became the drummer, and the whole band were American except for me. And all of them were music school graduates. And I was like, and I remember being at a rehearsal where they were talking about changes in the song and they were using numbers, you know. And I was like, what are you guys talking about? And I, yeah, once they clued me in, I was like, oh my God, I feel like such a numbskull. I remember I was still living in Chicago. So that was early 84. And I remember going and taking music theory classes in Chicago.
Where?
Because it was someplace called the Bloom School of Music. I don't know if it still exists, but I remember, and bear in mind, 10 years earlier, Joe had tried to give me theory lessons when he was still going to the London Royal Academy. I still have some of them in files here somewhere, handwritten music theory classes that Joe gave me. And I wasn't really ready to receive the information at that point. But in 1984, now I'm working with these great musicians and I'm feeling very insecure about my abilities. And I went to these theory classes and suddenly all the pieces fell into place and I was like, oh, okay. And that was wonderful. Like I got it and I felt like, well, now I'm going to be working with these good people that can fill in the gaps for me. And I started to feel like I might be able to work with other people. But the first artist I worked with other than Joe was 1985, 86. I started working with Marshall Crenshaw.
Right.
And I already knew him. So he was very keen to have me in his band. So.
So did he come to you and say, hey, I want you to be on this? I think you were on what, Mary Jane and Nine Others and Good Evening and Good Evening after that.
Right. Well, after the Body and Soul tour, Joe was burned out at the end of that tour. And he basically said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to make an album, do a tour. He was, so I was still, you know, I was now living in New Jersey and I was, oh my God, I got to find someone else to work with. And I know Marshall had mentioned something about working, about a tour. So I can't remember who called who, but he asked me to go on the road in, that was 85. I guess that was fall of 85. And I wasn't even on bass on that tour. He had a trio at that point and he added a guitar player and me. And I was actually playing acoustic guitar and six string bass on that tour. And all five of us sang, and that was a great tour. That was a lot of fun. It was the first time I had done a tour with anybody else. Then the following year, Aunt Marshall was doing another album and asked me to play bass on it, and that was Mary Jean. And this was all confidence building for me because I really had only worked with Joe and I didn't know if I could just work with other people. I mean, as silly as that sounds, I really hadn't the background I'm British, so I'm very reserved about my abilities.
Huh. Did Marshall Crenshaw come in with different, you know, did he present songs in different ways? Like, did he sort of...
Yeah, that was different from Joe because he did not have specific bass lines in mind. So I liked that right away, you know, that like he had really good songs, of course, because it's Marshall. But, you know, but we tried different things out and he liked some things and more than others. And that's how that worked out. So that was very satisfying. I hadn't recorded an album like that because Joe is, as I said, Joe always has very clear ideas, you know. And it wasn't like Marshall didn't know what he wanted, but the parts were a little, he was a little looser about parts. Yeah, he was open to ideas, I should
right.
say.
And that was refreshing for you because you were just sort of used to sort of having a little more outlined and demoed at that point.
Yeah. And then years later, I was, you know, 10 years after that, I was 1997, I was working with Natalie Merchant, who also had really nice songs, but she did not have arrangements or parts at all. And no disrespect, I love Natalie, but that was the first time I'd worked with someone who it's like the opposite end of the spectrum to Joe. It's like, well, you know, I felt like we chased our tail in the studio trying this arrangement or this feel and until something worked. And I hadn't worked that way before, you know, so everything took a lot longer.
Right.
And I remember that was the time that it first really struck me all those years later that working with Joe has always been in the studio has always been so quick and not deliberated. And that's largely because he had such a clear idea of what he's looking for, what he wants.
So, right. And then Marshall Crenshaw was somewhere in the middle of, because it sounds like that Natalie Merchant was a little more trial and error than you would have liked.
Yeah. Yeah. A little more. Well, I mean, you know, it can be frustrating. You know, I always remember there's a song on the album called Ophelia, the best selling album I ever played on.
Hmm.
And that was, that came out in 1998, and that's my first album with Natalie, and it sold, I think, 1.5 million or something, and it was a commercial failure because her first solo album had sold like 4 million copies. So 1.5 million was a disappointment, and it's the best album, the biggest selling album I've ever played on.
Night and Day didn't get there.
It got to 1 million eventually, slowly, not right away, but it did get there.
Interesting. Did you have a conflict at some point? I mean, I know you're not on the album Big World, when Joe Jackson finally went back and recorded one, it was kind of his live record without audience sounds on it. And then you were back for Blaze of Glory. Did he want you back for that one too, but you were tied up with Marshall Crenshaw, or what was happening at that point?
Well, the story was because he had said he didn't want to tour anymore. I accepted the gig with Marshall. And then right after I had accepted the gig with Marshall in 1985, Joe called me up and said, oh, I've written some new songs and I want to start work on a new project. And I'm like, hang on, Joe, you said you were done for a while. So I've got this tour coming up. And he's, well, can't you get out of it? And I'm like, well, no, I've kind of been looking forward to it. And so he was kind of pissed at me for a while after that. Because he thought I would drop everything and just, you know. So that's why I didn't do Big World. So that was the project that I didn't do. And that was the reason why. And then we eventually communicated and you know, everything was laid, you know, that we settled our scores. And,
right.
And by the time Blaze of Glory came around, the guy that replaced me, my friend Rick Ford, actually, is also on, he was on Big World and he was also on several songs on Blaze of Glory and I'm on the rest. So it was like two bass players on the album. But I did do the tour and then, yeah, so we kind of settled our differences and moved on from that. So.
Was it nice going back to that?
It was, and it was especially because it was a big band. It was like probably the biggest band Joe's ever had. Four horn players and two guitar players, you know, because Joe was, the other thing about Night and Day, no guitar players. So, you know, which for some reason was outrageous to the American press. Like, how can it be rock and roll if there's no guitar, you know? So by the time he did Blaze of Glory, he had actually two guitar players. Drums, percussion, keyboards, four horn players, bass. Joy Askew was singing, and yeah, so that was a fun tour. I thought that was a great band. I enjoyed it.
Do you play differently if like a guitar's up front versus keyboards, and you know, if it's like small band versus huge band?
I don't really think it's the lineup. It's about the song, really. You know, I don't think about how many people or how few people are on stage. I mean, obviously, there's more space to fill in if there's few musicians.
Right. That's kind of what I was thinking about. Like, if you have a lot of left-hand piano, then, you know, you're maybe playing differently than if it's, you know, guitar, bass, drums.
That's, I hate that. Especially when you're working with a piano player who is heavy on the left hand. That, because the low end can get muddy so easily. And you have to, then you find you're psyching yourself out trying to find a way to avoid treading on what he's doing, which, when I really think maybe it should be the other way around, you know. But anyway.
2000, you had Night and Day 2. And then 2003, you had Volume 4, which was the return of the Joe Jackson Band.
Right.
And I was kind of curious how that happened, where you got the original band back together, you know, so many years later for that album.
I'm still trying to figure it out too, Mark. I don't know. I remember talking to Joe in 2002 about that. And I was like, is he saying what I, you know, like, I thought I must be hearing things, you know, because I would have thought Joe would be the last person on earth who would want to put the band back together, you know, but he had a bunch of songs and he knew we were coming up for 25 years since the first album came out. And he just plowed on with that concept and wrote a whole album's worth of songs, contacted everyone, and everyone was up for it. And I actually think that's a really good album. I don't know if you've heard it, but
yeah, it sounds like you guys.
It's a well-recorded album. I think the songs are pretty darn good, and the energy. I mean, I was calling us a bunch of old farts then, but of course that was 20 years ago. So, but we were all, you know, around 50, and I thought we had the energy. We still, Dave was playing great. That's one of my favorite albums with Joe, is Volume 4.
Was it something where everyone came back together and it just sort of felt like old times, or was there kind of a weird adjustment that had to be made because you guys are all older and have a lot more, you know, water under the bridge?
I hadn't seen Gary for quite a long time. Obviously, I saw Joe periodically and worked with Joe. You know, and Dave and I have been friends and we stayed in touch through the years. But the first rehearsal we had for Volume 4, the first song we played was, I think, One More Time. And Joe said, all right, well, let's not think about it too much. Let's just dive back in and see what happens. And we did one more. And at the end of that, we all looked at each other like, wow, it's like 25 years just didn't happen. Yeah, it was all still there. There was no adjustment. We just kicked right back into it.
Yeah. And I saw you you guys play at Park West, I guess it was 2 years ago, 2022.
One of my favorite clubs, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, and you guys sounded fantastic. So Fool had come out in 2019, and then you probably didn't really get a chance to tour behind that as much as you wanted because of the pandemic. And I remember that you guys alternated, like you would do One More Time and then you do one of the new songs and then you do another Look Sharp song. I think the first six songs was like alternating between three Look Sharp songs and three of the new album songs, just to show,
we're
doing what we did. Like, we're not, like, it's not a throwback, but it's like, it's consistent. This makes sense.
Well, another thing is that Joe, when presenting older songs, he's got a history of wanting to rearrange them to make them interesting for himself, but also for the audience. And what we did on that tour was we played Is She Really Going Out With Him, Look Sharp, and One More Time, pretty much exactly like the record.
Right.
Except obviously the drummer and the guitar player were different, but there was no arrangement, nothing different about the arrangements. And that's because Joe's audience know that he usually will do some change up of arrangement. So he figured out just to play the songs the way they are recorded would be a surprise, because he hardly ever does that. And so, yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's why.
And also showing the through line between the way he was doing stuff then and the way he was doing stuff on Fool, because those songs from Fool sounded perfectly at home being right next to, you know, Sunday Papers and, you know, Is She Really Going Out With Him and One More Time. So that was and then I remember Stepping Out was a totally different arrangement. So,
right. Well, were we doing Stepping Out? Were we doing the slow version, or did we do the version? Did you see us do the version where we had the drum machine and I was playing the Glockenspiel?
No, I heard the slow. It was the slow version. Okay. The drum machine and the Glockenspiel sounds fun.
That was, well, he basically walked the audience through how he made that recording. So he brought out the original. It was like some emulator, one of those drum machines from.
That's funny.
You know, and he actually had one, and the drummer would just push the button, you know, and start it. And the only thing the drummer did was play the snare drum throughout. Like the rest of the drum track was the cheesy electronic drum machine from 1982. And then I played the Glockenspiel part, and the bass part was programmed, which it is on the record.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, on the original of Stepping Out, whether that sort of pulsating bass is actually a bass, or if that's like a keyboard thing or a program thing.
Yeah, it's a program keyboard thing. For the album recording, I think he kept that, a couple of aspects of the demo, and then just added, you know, just souped it up a bit.
Have you talked to him recently? Is there like another, you know, album that you guys are going to be working on after the What a Racket tour?
We haven't talked about that yet because he's been consumed with the Max Champion thing.
Right.
I don't know what he's got cooking, but it wouldn't surprise me if he wanted to do another tour with the same lineup. That's been the band that you saw has actually been playing together for 9 years. Since the first tour we did together was for Fast Forward, which was in 2015.
Right.
And he loves that lineup. So I would be surprised if he didn't want to do some more work with that lineup. But, you know, he's in the middle of this Max Champion thing yet. So I think he probably doesn't want to think about, if I know Joe, he doesn't want to think about next month. You know, he just wants to focus on what he's doing right now.
Do you want to do another album and tour with him?
Sure. Why not? Yeah. Of course. I'm not so busy, and people associate me with Joe, so it's always very gratifying to appear on stage with him, because a lot of people in the audience seem to be very warmly disposed toward me. So, you know, my wife is very fond of telling me how lucky I am to get that instant gratification. You know, you play a song for 3 minutes and everybody kind of goes bonkers, you know. And I know I would miss that. So, and I'm not playing out so much anymore. So,
do other artists call you up and say, "Hey, I really love that Graham Mabey bass part on my record"? You know, like some 20-something rock guy who's trying to make it.
Yeah, I actually did a session last month with a guy who was producing his song knew me, and when my name came up, said, "Oh, can you get him?" You know? So of course he initially said he wanted that sound. But when I listened to the song, I was like, I don't think that's the right sound for this song at all. You know, he wanted me to use a pick, which I was using a lot on the first album. And the song didn't call for it. I said, well, look, listen, I'll play it with the pick. Now listen to me playing with the fingers with the treble rolled off a little bit. And of course, that was the right call. So, and it sounded really good. So, right. So sometimes people think that they want what they want, but then I think maybe they don't know that I can actually do other things too. So
there you go. I always love when, you know, you read interviews with musicians and they're like, "Oh, I was really thinking of this band at the time I did this song." And you're like, "That doesn't sound anything like that." But I'm glad that you came up, you used that as a stepping stone to get to where you were going, even though the thing that you did as in my mirrors is no relation to the thing that you thought you were doing. So there's like, it's like what Harold Ramis said about filmmaking. It's like, there's the movie you set out to make, the movie you think you're making, and the movie it turns out you made. And those are three different films.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. That applies to music too. Yeah. Yeah. Because what may be inspiring you is not what people hear at all when you're finished. And maybe that's good, because I think we're all, I mean, any artist is, it's unrealistic to think you're not going to be influenced by the musical climate that you're working in. I mean, and it's not necessarily desirable to remove yourself from it so that what you're doing is pure. I mean, who does that? And why would you want to do that?
Right.
You know? So, yeah, I think I've heard that before, that people imagine, I think even the Beatles, you know, like when Paul McCartney's doing Got to Get You Into My Life, he's thinking of Motown, but it doesn't really sound like Motown.
No, exactly. That's a good example.
Right. It sounds like a great Paul McCartney song with the
horns on it. Do you have any, is there like a sort of secret stash of, you know, home recordings that are going to come out at some point that you've been, you know, you've been working on over the years?
Over my dead body. Yeah, I've got a bunch of stuff, but unfortunately, you know, one thing I always do say to younger musicians is write songs, because I do think that's incredibly important. Because without somebody writing songs, there's no songs for musicians to play. And I did used to write songs, and then I would demo them. And some of them came out okay. And a lot of them, by the time I finished making the demo, I hated the song and never wanted to hear it again. So there's a mixture of that. And I don't know. I'm very conflicted about that. So,
have you played them for anyone who might be a little more objective than you?
A few of them, yeah.
You playing for Joe?
Yeah, Joe. You know, years ago I wrote this song called Wild West that I actually liked the song very much. And I didn't know he was going to get to hear it. And someone played it for him. And he got back to me and he said, yeah, I like that demo you did of that song, Wild West. And he said, do you mind if I use that title? Because I've got a song and I was thinking of calling it the same thing. And I was like, oh, I can't exactly copyright Wild West, you know,
right. So
knock your socks off, you know. And so he did, and it's on Big World.
Right. Yeah, I was saying it's on the album you're not even on. I was wondering if it's sort of dated back then, because yeah, that's an 86 record. So you'd demoed it back in the early in the mid 80s. Did the songs have any relation to each other, or did you just take the title?
Not at all. No.
You didn't have the good and the bad and the ugly whistling on yours?
No, nothing like that at all. There's a few songs I'm proud of, and there's a few songs that I would have liked to have. You know, I mean, I didn't have the discipline and the stick-to-itiveness that you have to have to be a good songwriter. I think you have to set aside time and do it frequently, and be, you know, and just be prepared to write some duds and hope that now and again, you'll come up with something good. I never had that. I mean, first of all, I was never prolific. Actually, some of the most fun I had as a songwriter was a friend of mine gave me some tracks that he had just with a drum machine and a guitar part. And he said, and he played them for me. And I said, oh, I'll put some bass and vocals on. And I wrote lyrics and played bass. We did two songs like that. And I kind of thought I could work like that. I really enjoyed that, but see, this is me. I didn't follow up.
Well, yeah, that sounds like me too. As an outside person who's totally, you know, talking out of his hat when I don't really have any business to say anything, it sounds to me like if you've been writing and recording songs since the mid 80s, you probably would have enough to like have like a Bandcamp page or a SoundCloud page where you just put up some of it and people could listen to it.
Well, thank you.
Just a little thought. I don't know. Take it or leave it.
Well, you know, I need to go back and re-record stuff. It's what I need to do.
You probably don't need to.
There's actually one song that a couple of friends of mine really liked, and they were egging me on to re-record it. So maybe I'll re-record that one. So yeah, that would be a good start.
Could also just be period piece. This is a demo you did. People release demos and stuff now. So, you know.
Oh, no.
Like I said, Andy Partridge has released more albums of demos than many artists have released albums. So
And some people's demos are magical. I mean, Marshall's early demos were magical, I thought. You know, like You're My Favorite Waste of Time.
I was going to say You're My Favorite Waste of Time is basically the demo, right?
I mean, you couldn't make it better than that if you spent a week in a recording studio with the best musicians, you know. So
you ever go back and play with him again?
Yeah, you know, every now and again he surprises me and calls me up, and we do a few gigs. It's been a couple of years, but yeah, we're still on good terms. He does a lot of solo gigs, but I think he's actually found a consistent rhythm section that he's been doing some gigs with. So, but like I said, no hard feelings between us whatsoever. But I don't work with him on any consistent basis anymore.
Well, thank you for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
I've actually been writing my memoir for the last 15 years or more. You know, I go in fits and starts. Again, I'm just terribly undisciplined, but I'm getting towards the end. I've got like 30 something chapters under my belt, and the light is at the end of the tunnel. So I feel like I got to plug that, because I made the mistake of mentioning it to someone a few years ago, and now people ask me about it all the time. Like, oh, is your book out yet? So I want to say I'm hoping to get it finished soon. And I don't know how I'm going to put it out. I don't know if I'm going to find a publisher, because memoirs are a dime a dozen these days.
Good talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
That's all for episode 140 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Graham Mabey for being such a gracious, insightful guest, as he illuminated much of the great music that he has played. He's not performing much right now, but you never know what's coming up. In the meantime, if you want to get to know his music and playing better, start with Joe Jackson's Look Sharp and move forward. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake. He's the man. For a mere $24, you could become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.